Our first reading is the first 10 verses of Luke chapter 15. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost." Just so I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light up a lamp, sweep the house, and seek diligently until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost." Just so I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents.
We're carrying on in Luke chapter 15, starting at verse 11. And he said, "There was a man who had 2 sons, and the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants."' And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion, and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. And bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf, because he has received him back safe and sound.' But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.'"
Harry and Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, have launched a non-profit organisation called Archwell. And the stated aim of this non-profit is to unleash the power of compassion. Well, that's a noble ambition, surely. Who in any context could object to unleashing the power of compassion? Well, it turns out quite a few. In Jesus' day, there were quite a number who took issue with compassion. And it actually turns out it's the same today. But you might say, well, where would we find these people who object to unleashing the power of compassion? And the answer is, more often than not, in the church itself. Well, this evening we are in Luke chapter 15. Jesus is on the road to Jerusalem. And along the way, he's teaching in parables, and chapter 15, 1 and 2 set the scene for us. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear Jesus, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Well, after that introduction, we then get three parables, and the third of which we're looking at tonight, is the parable of the prodigal son. As you'll know, it is one of the most famous stories ever told. But why did Jesus tell it? Well, that's what we're going to try and find out. And we see that at its heart, this parable is about the compassion of the father. So we know the man has two sons, and the youngest says, "Father, give me the share of the property that is coming to me." Oh, and are we shocked by that? Just imagine being the father who hears this. It's obvious the father cares deeply for his sons, and yet this son wants out. He wants the money, not in the future, he won't wait, he wants it now. And he doesn't care what his father thinks about that. And then once he's got the money, he doesn't hang around, does he? Not many days later, he's out of there. Verse 13, the younger son gathered all that he had and took a journey into a far country. Again, just imagine the father watching his son, maybe going around the house, gathering his things. And the father would know, now that he has given that son his inheritance, he is of no use to the son. And the son is simply discarding him like rubbish. And sure enough, the son leaves the house, down the path, along the road, journeying on far away and over the horizon. It seems it doesn't matter where, just far away from the father. And then presumably not a word from him. Who knows, maybe the father heard news from others. Maybe he heard that his son was still alive. Maybe he heard what his son was getting up to. But maybe still not a personal word directly from the son. You can imagine, can't you, every day that father staring out the window, looking along that road on which his son had left. Someone's coming, but no, it's not him, again and again. Maybe the days stretching into weeks, into months, maybe even longer. Until, again, one day, that dot on the horizon, slowly coming closer, could it be? Maybe the father recognized the gait of his son. And so the father starts running. Now this is totally unbecoming of a man of his age and station. But frankly, who cares? He ran and he ran. And as he gets closer, yes, it's his son. Oh, yeah, he looks very different, emaciated, filthy, in rags. Get even closer, the stink of pigs. But it is him. And so again, not a moment's hesitation, he runs on until he has embraced this stinking mess of a son and kissed him. It's an awkward moment in many ways. This is not the done thing at all. Who knows what the son is thinking? It's just so totally over the top. It's exuberant. Because the father just can't help himself, and the son is no doubt stunned. What a welcome. What a welcome. And it is all driven, verse 20, by the father's compassion. So what is God like? Well, it's easy to say. It trips off the tongue. He is compassionate. We're used to saying that. We've sung about it this evening. But Jesus' aim is that we see it more. We feel it more deeply. In fact, that we are utterly blown away by it. Because then you begin to realize that because the Father's compassion is so great, it has one very obvious consequence, which is it is simply not possible to be too far from God. So do think of a moment of that person you find really difficult. Just think for you, that individual who you really do think is a nasty piece of work. Who is it that you know they've got no time for God and their life shows it? Maybe if you like, just imagine that person. Just imagine you saw Jesus having dinner with that person and you would feel an overwhelming urge just to fill Jesus in on what they are really like. Or maybe this evening you are acutely aware that that person is you. That the way you and I have behaved is appalling. That we've grabbed God's stuff for ourselves, thanks very much, but God himself, no thanks. Because sin is that sort of personal rejection of our Creator. And yet, the compassion of God for the thoroughly undeserving goes even deeper. So verse 20, the Father saw him and felt compassion. And obviously, it's no mere feeling. This is a compassion that acts. In fact, of course, it's Jesus saying this on the road to Jerusalem, so this couldn't be plainer. In fact, we could say, so that God could throw his arms around that wayward son, the arms of Jesus had to be stretched out on the cross. Here we see the costly compassion of the Father. Second, we see in this passage, the son who celebrated his father's compassion, the son who celebrated his father's compassion. So let's catch up. What had that younger son been up to off in the far country? Verse 13 just simply sums it up. He squandered his property in reckless living. The Bible translator William Tyndale rendered verse 13 like this. He wasted his goods with riotous, that's riotous, living. Or maybe you've seen the Rembrandt portraits. He painted two portraits of the prodigal son. The more famous one is probably the after picture. The son has returned and is kneeling before the father. But maybe more powerful is the before picture. It's called the prodigal son in the tavern, or sometimes the prodigal son in the brothel. It's a picture simply of a man sitting with a woman on his lap. And Jesus here is deftly painting a picture of humanity, that God made us. He gave us every good thing we needed to flourish. And yet we thought, well, I think life will be better off without God. So we strike out on our own, decide what we think is going to be fun, and we leave God firmly out of the picture. And it won't end well. Probably in this life, certainly in eternity. And that was the younger son's experience. Look down with me to verse 14. When he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So much so, of course, we know he went to work for this pig keeper. What a life. Well, it's no life at all, is it? We're told he even longed for the pig food. But verse 16, no one gave him anything. And again, that's just a glimpse into our world, what it's really like apart from God. No one gave him anything. Of course, everyone loved the son when he was the life and soul of the party, when the drinks were on him, when others could see what they could get out of him. But now when he has nothing to give them, tossed on the scrap heap. And that's our selfish world. No one gave him anything. But of course, it's languishing in that pigsty that the younger son certainly has time to think. And verse 17 tells us he came to himself, or we might say he came to his senses. He realized, verse 17 goes on, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger. It dawned on him how stupid he had been. Life would be far better, even as a servant of his father. And so, verse 18, he says, I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. treat me as one of your hired servants. Well, those are stirring words in a way, aren't they? What a change. Look at all that he had realized. Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. Yes, that's definitely true. Sin is against God and it matters. So he goes on, I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Yep, that is true, given his behavior. Treat me as one of your hired servants. So it's an accurate understanding of himself. We might say a model response. Or is it? Have a think. Look again at verses 18 and 19 and what he says he's going to say. Is that a model response or not? Because it turns out that the younger son is not the first in the Bible to say something like this. Listen to this. It's on the sheet if you've got it there. Someone else has said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now, therefore, forgive my sin. So again, if you thought the younger son made a model response, you'd think that was a model response. But again, is it? Now, in Luke 15, alert listeners, either to Jesus originally or to us now, may have picked up there are a number of connections to the Exodus account in the Old Testament. I guess maybe most obviously we're told at the beginning that the Pharisees are grumbling. That was, of course, the defining sin of the Israelites back in the wilderness. So with Exodus in mind, again, the question is, who said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you, now therefore forgive my sin? Well, those are the words of Pharaoh. Why did he say it? Well, do you remember the plagues? After 8 devastating plagues, just had the hail and the locusts, every tree and plant of the field in the land of Egypt had been destroyed. So obviously that meant there was no food, there was famine. So no food even for Pharaoh, which is again, is just like that younger son in Luke 15. And that's when Pharaoh said those words. And he tells us that he said that so that God would, quote, remove this death from me. Well, in Exodus, God in his compassion did take away the plagues. But you probably know that no sooner had God done that than Pharaoh refused to let the people of Israel go. So what had happened? Well, it's clear to see that when Pharaoh was in need, well, he said to God what he thought would serve his best interests. But then once the locusts were gone, well, Pharaoh now thought his purposes were better served by keeping hold of the Israelites. So that's what he did. And now think of that younger son again, what he planned to say. Well, it was true, and he may well have believed it up to a point, but maybe the giveaway is that last line in verse 19. Treat me as one of your hired servants. Now again, that is an accurate statement of what we would say that younger son deserved, at best really. But just have a think for a moment. What does it say about his father? Was it true for that younger son to say that the best that he could hope for was to persuade his father to take him on as a laborer in the field? What is this younger son thinking? Verses 15 and 19, if you look later, they both speak of hired servants. Whether a hired servant of one of the citizens of the far country or a hired servant of the father. And it seems to me the young son, as he thinks about this, has just tried to work out which would be better. Which would be better, to be starving hungry with the pigs or to have more than enough bread? Well, the answer is obvious, isn't it? It's a no-brainer. Much better to be a servant of the father. And so what's he doing? Well, in effect, he's thinking how to make a deal with God. It's going to cost him. He knows he's going to have to work for it, but he'll win. It'll be an improvement on the pigsty. But notice what there's no hint of in what he says. There's no desire to be back with the father. In a sense, he hasn't really changed. So you could say a few facts of life have dawned on him. But actually, whether he's headed to the far country or coming back, either way, it's all about serving his own best interests apart from the father. So why today do people look into Christian things? Why do they come to church? Why are you here in church? Because maybe life has gone wrong for you and you've realized that. You've messed up maybe badly. Maybe you realize things actually do need to change. And so maybe you wonder, well, maybe some sort of spirituality. Well, maybe even Christianity. In fact, maybe even listening to Jesus will make my life better. And so such a person then finds that as they put a few spiritual, or we could even say biblical principles into practice, they make supportive Christian friends, and their life does come into a little bit of order. The chaos decreases. But has there really been a change in that person's view of God and their relationship with him? So the younger son has told us what he's going to say, and now imagine him making that journey home, no doubt anxious, maybe with a heavy heart. You know, would his father even listen long enough to hear this proposal? How would the negotiations go for working as a servant, as a hired hand? But you can imagine now, as the son is heading home, he, in the distance, sees someone coming closer, fast, because he's running. Surely not, the younger son thinks, but it is. It's his father. And clearly not angry. Father gets closer and closer, and the father doesn't stop until the younger son is engulfed in his arms. And it seems in his father's arms, that's when a change takes place in this younger son. I wonder if you notice how the account here is structured for us. Rarely in Bible narrative do we get the same thing recorded twice. But when we do, there's normally a reason for that. And that's what we get here. Remember how, verses 18 and 19, we are told what the younger son is going to say. So we know that already. But then in verse 21, it gets reported for us what he actually does say. And it's not quite the same. Take a look as we read verse 21. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But that's it. Do you notice what's changed between verses 18 and 19 and then 21? The last line is now missing. He no longer says, treat me as one of your hired servants. Because of course, why would he say that? He's realized at long last, he now knows. This is no business negotiation. This is his father. A father who, it's now become clear what presumably he saw all his life, one who is full of compassion. Full of compassion even now for a stupid, arrogant, rebellious son like him. What was he thinking that the father would treat him as a mere hired servant? As if he would need to do some sort of penance. What had he been thinking? Well, in fact, verse 22, the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet and bring the fattened calf and kill it and let us eat and celebrate. I love the irony here. Do you remember what this son no doubt got up to when he was far away? Did he really need another party? Well, the father seems to think so. And it really is a party. He pulls out all the stops, the fattened calf, it's all there. Let's celebrate. Because the father had always been compassionate. But now, when, if you like, the son had put that to the test in the most dramatic, personal way imaginable, the father had responded by going above and beyond. And so now, father and son together celebrate. And I think we can say now there is nowhere else that son would want to be but with his father. Well, for us, I wonder, as we look to the cross of the Lord Jesus, what do we see? Is that a God that we want to know? A God that we want to be with? Because that's what happened to the younger son. In fact, verse 24 tells us, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. So we've seen the compassion of the father. we've seen the son who celebrated that father's compassion. But there's more. Third, we now see the son who hated his father's compassion. The son who hated his father's compassion. So imagine now the older son coming in from his day's work. You can imagine from afar, he hears the music, gets a bit closer, the laughing, a bit closer, the clinking of glasses. Servant comes out and shares the great news. Your brother is back. He is safe and sound. We are celebrating. No way. There is nothing, he might say, there was to celebrate. Why? Well, we're told he's angry. Verse 29 tells us why. He answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him." I wonder, have we realized that the gospel is a scandal? It really is. At least to those who think it's all about keeping your nose clean, putting in the hard yards, and God will serve you right. No, here we have a man disowning his own loving father, spending the proceeds on cocaine and hookers, and the father welcomes him home and celebrates. And that's the gospel. It is scandalous. The Puritan preacher Thomas Hooker understood this. He was on his deathbed after a lifetime of faithful service. His attendant said to him that he would soon receive the reward for all his labors, to which he replied, "Brother, I'm going to receive mercy." So who is this older son? Well, he's never rebelled, has he, against his parents? He's worked hard all the way through at school and then at university. He never went off the rails, quite the opposite. He got a decent job here in the city, came to London. St. Helens was recommended to him, and dutifully he went along straight away, went to the welcome evening, joined a small group, regular. He served in a number of ways. But then he saw someone joining, and he realized that God was welcoming someone who had done none of those things. In fact, quite the opposite. And this older son is simply livid. He is furious. It's intolerable. A lavish display of God's grace has actually exposed what's in his heart. Notice in verse 30, this older son says to his father, "This son of yours," for which, of course, the more usual description would be, "my brother." But he can't say it. And nor do we hear him say the word father. Now, in his defense, someone might want to say, well, but hasn't he served his father for years? Well, we now realize what's really been happening. So yes, he's done lots of, so to speak, right things. He hasn't done the wrong things. But what's going on? Why was he doing it? And that's going to be exposed. How could he see his father condone his brother's behavior? Well, look again in verse 29. He tells us he never got to celebrate with his friends. And remember, he says that at the very same time as he's refusing to celebrate with his father. So you might ask, what did he want to do with his friends? Well, again, just listen again to verse 30, where he announces that his brother devoured your property with prostitutes. Well, maybe we're meant to wonder, how did the older son know what his brother had been doing? It may well have been a fair assumption, but still. Could it even be that even as the older son worked dutifully in the fields, resenting his younger brother, he was actually secretly wishing that he too could? But what was going on in his heart? Now, in this parable, the contrasts between the older and the younger brother are obvious. One's a party animal hedonist, the other a dutiful hard worker. And yet by the end, we are meant to see the similarity. Remember, the younger son thought life worth living, well, that's to be found apart from the father. But it seems so did the older son. Oh yes, the older son was on the family property still, but it's obvious he's as far away as his brother was. Someone can sit in church every week and yet be a million miles away from God. Well, the father responds to his older son in verse 31. He said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad. For this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found." Well, what are we seeing in those words of the father? It's yet more compassion. It's wonderful. Notice the father has already come out of the son, out of the house, I mean, to see the older son, just like he did for the younger. And notice the father doesn't hesitate to use the name son. That older son's view of the father that he's just explained to us, as if the father is making him lose out. Well, that was wrong and unfair and hurtful. But still, the father graciously says to him, "All that is mine is yours." And he also says, verse 31, "You are always with me." And that is the challenge for this older son. Is that what he wants or not? Does the older son realize that really is the greatest blessing imaginable, to be with him? Surely, why hadn't the older son, seeing how his father had treated the younger son, actually have been thrilled to think, "I've got a father like that"? Surely the older son would have been delighted to celebrate with that younger son, knowing that they were fellow sons with such a compassionate father. Have you ever considered what this older son also didn't do, apart from not celebrate? Now, in Luke 15, at the beginning, there are two other shorter parables also about lostness. You'll remember them. One, the sheep wanders off, and of course, the shepherd goes looking. Then there's the coin that is unaccounted for, and the woman hunts high and low. So notice, if we were reading for the first time, we would be sensing a pattern. Something gets lost, one goes searching for it. And so when here the younger son goes off and doesn't return, what should that older son do? Well, surely go out looking, bring him back. If only there was a son who, when he sees lost people, leaves where he is to seek and to save the lost, even to leave the glory of heaven, determined even to set his face towards Jerusalem where he knows a cross awaits. Wouldn't it be wonderful news if there was such a son? Which is Jesus' challenge to the Pharisees listening in to this parable. Do you remember how it was set up, what we were told at the beginning? They saw Jesus with sinners and tax collectors. I'll remind us, sinners. Well, they were notorious for a reason. They were bad people. They were. And then there's tax collectors. Let me just ask you, have you ever been ripped off? And how did you feel about that? Well, that's what the tax collectors did. And in fact, worse, they were traitors. Remember, they sided with the oppressive Roman occupiers. So today, they would be the ones ready to tell the Taliban in Afghanistan where the Christians live. And Jesus went for dinner with them all. You see, God, in his compassion, welcomes sinners and tax collectors, and with them the religious hypocrites as well. And he'll do whatever it takes to give them full membership in his family. And yet, despite all that, and despite the Pharisees knowing their Bibles, how do they respond? They grumble. They just haven't got it, what God is like, despite all their religiosity. So this parable is a pointed challenge to those Pharisees. And we're not told how they respond. It's left open, as it is for us. Having heard Jesus' great story, this wonderful story, the question is, who do we think that Jesus came for? Did he come for nice people like us? or for rebellious, disobedient outsiders like us. Put it this way, this coming year, who would we like to see join us here at St. Helens? Who would we like to spend our time with? Who would we celebrate having with us? More respectable people like us? There'll be great banter in the small group. We'll get on really well. You know, friends we can have for life. Or would it thrill us if there were more people who are so obviously far away from God? Because London is lost. London needs Jesus, the one who came to seek and to save the lost. And ultimately, it comes down to what do we think God is like, really? Have we begun to see and feel the depth of his compassion? Such compassion to give his son for lost sinners like us. And then what's our response? I'll lead us in a prayer. The Father saw him and felt compassion. Our Father, we so praise you that when we turned against you, you did not leave us in our sin, but in your deep compassion, you sent your Son even to the cross. And so would you cause us to see again the wonder of your compassion, even towards us. And so would we join the celebration whenever the lost are found and the dead are brought to life for your glory. Amen.